You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
If you're forced to live in exile, how important is homeland anyway? Those are questions that authors Brighton Breitenbach and Dubravko Ugresic have both addressed in their work. He's originally from South Africa. She grew up in what's now Croatia, and both live elsewhere. They're sharing a stage for the first time for a reading and Q&A tonight at the 92nd Street Y. Mr. Breitenbach's latest book is All One Horse, published by Archipelago, and Ms. Ugresic's latest book is Nobody's Home, published by Open Letter Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome them to the show today. Hello.
Hello.
So how important is homeland in your writing? Norman Mania, a Romanian writer who lives in the United States, says that he brings his country with him through the Romanian language. Is that the same for you, Dubravka?
Yes, I still, in fact, use this language of Serbo-Croatian, nowadays divided into four languages, meaning Croatian, Serbian, Bosnian, and very soon probably we will get the fourth one, Montenegrin. So
it's ironic because in the end of the 19th century there was a move to find the similarities between those four languages and create one language, and now with the breakup of Yugoslavia they're finding all of the differences and stressing that
only shows you that language is in fact a political thing. I mean, when you have a state you need a language and culture too.
Well, you have a number of essays in the book that have a strong sense of place, but the title is Nobody's Home. So is that a reflection of an exile sensibility?
It could be of anything. In fact, the title could mean something to East Europeans of my generation who remember a Czech movie. For children. It was a children's movie or series, and there was a little boy. Parents would leave him at home, and when somebody would knock on the door, he would answer, "Nobody's home." So.
And that's a reference that people in Eastern Europe would be aware of.
I believe so, yes.
Have you become attached to other places after you left Zagreb?
Attached to other places, of
course. Or is it because I remember speaking to Jose Donoso, who was sent into exile during the Pinochet years, and he lived in Spain and always thought back to Santiago as this incredibly wonderful place. And then when he was allowed to return, he came back. He said, "This is nothing like what I remember. This is a backwater town," and it was a terrible moment of disillusionment for him.
It is always. I'm coming back all the time. So I don't have any romantic ideas about the home. Probably nor I have any romantic ideas about exile too. So,
well, in your case, you write in two languages. So are they both your homes?
Probably in different ways. I would say that the language, my mother tongue, Afrikaans, is probably a home that is no longer there, no longer exists, not even objectively.
But you write your poetry in Afrikaans.
I still write my poetry in that language, but it's not something that I could use to go back to. I mean, I can. Of course, there are many other people who still use Afrikaans, but Afrikaans, the function of it, the position of it, has been changing for quite a while now. So
I mean, since
early 1990s, since the new regime, since the liberation in South Africa, and this is true of some other languages in the country as well. But of course, I do also write in English. I'm not sure whether one could call English a home language or a home country because it's so worldwide and it's so universal to a large extent. And then I work in French, where I live, actually.
Well, go ahead.
I was just thinking that it would probably have different. I probably change clothes and change hats and change skins when I move from one language into the other.
Well, when you write prose in English, you're obviously finding something in English that works for prose,
yes,
and something different in Afrikaans when you write poetry.
Yes, I think it's to some extent the differences between poetry and prose. I think for me at least, poetry is not really literature. It's a way of life. It's a way of seeing the world. It's a way of being in the world that is so ancient and goes back to gestures and to rituals and to sounds and to textures. And of course, it expresses itself in language, and the linguistic part is very important. But I'd probably have difficulty now writing a full-length book in prose in Afrikaans, because I think for that you need to really live among the people and keep up with the rhythms that are being used on the street, etc. And English is not the same, yeah.
You left not because you were a political dissident, but just to go to art school?
You mean originally?
Yeah.
Yes, but it was a moment of intense political activism. I was at that time at the University of Cape Town. The universities were being segregated. The University of Cape Town was one of the last that still had, to a limited extent, an integrated South African student body, and they were segregating that too, so I became involved in student politics. There had been some political activism before I left, but yes, I left essentially because I wanted to go and continue my career as a painter start my career as a painter.
And you did. You were able to establish yourself as a painter in France, mm-hmm. and then you were published in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think your work was well received there, despite the fact that you were becoming a political dissident?
Because I think, and this might be something I'm sure that Lubowka would probably be sensitive to also, in a case of several cultural groups or groupings living within the same environment, the same state, the identification, the marker, the difference becomes very important. In the case of South Africa, it became horribly, obscenely important, the identity, white versus black, Afrikaans-speaking versus English-speaking, etc. And in those circumstances, under those circumstances, the language is very important. So even if you wrote as a dissident in a language, if you could use it in a way that they felt that one was expanding on the reaches of the language, it was a very odd, ambivalent relationship. On the one hand, they utterly rejected and expelled what one stood for politically, and the positions one took and the things you tried to say. But on the other hand, you were using the language which was a marker of their identity.
And it's interesting, in South Africa, a number of writers, Nadine Gordimer, Andre Brink, were able to write dissident works and continue, although they had to struggle.
Mm.
But then other things, something else got you in trouble. You didn't go to jail because of your writings.
No, I didn't. Although the writing was mixed up in it. I mean, I had some works banned, obviously, and even right during the first trial, one of the major accusations, or at least it was an important part of the trial, was a poem I'd written to the Prime Minister called Letter to Butcher from Abroad, and they obliged me to apologize in court for it. I mean, that was the one thing. He was not concerned about my being a terrorist or a communist and all the other things that I was accused of. But he really was hurt by this poem that I'd written to him. But indeed, yes, one was not being convicted. You're not being put to prison for literary activities. I became involved in political activities, yes.
You did get into trouble because you married a French woman of Vietnamese ancestry.
That also.
That was more of an offense.
You know, we had very strange laws, so it was very difficult not to break quite a number of laws nearly simultaneously. Yes, I was also I also broke the law against, it's called the Immorality Act or the Mixed Marriages Act. In fact, they extended the law to also make it illegal for people of different ethnic backgrounds or different races, it was called in, if you were South African, to marry even abroad, even if you were beyond their jurisdiction.
My guests are Brighton Breitenbach and Dubravka Ugresic, and we're talking about writing in exile, keeping a sense of homeland alive through the writing. One of your books, The True Confessions of an Albino Terrorist, describes aspects of the imprisonment. Did you write it while you were in prison?
No, I did write. There's another book called Mouroir, which I believe Archipelago Press is going to be publishing next year, republishing. But the prison memoir the one that you referred to just now, the confessions I wrote immediately afterwards, it would have been impossible to do so.
But you did write something called Poem on Toilet Paper, which would suggest that you were writing something in prison.
Of course, yes, of course. I mean, prison is a continuous struggle to try and, again, break all the restrictions, all the laws. And ultimately, you know, I even found in myself, slipped under my door, the Communist Manifesto. Can you imagine getting that in a South African jail in the 1980s and the 1970s? It was unbelievable. If you wait long enough, everything comes to you. No, after the second trial, which we made, we used the second trial to expose the conditions under which I was kept. There was very strong pressure from my colleagues, both from South Africa and abroad, for me to be allowed to continue writing. And so they allowed me under very, very specific conditions, numbered pages, a certain number a day, handed in at night. And of course, you couldn't refer to what was happening in prison. You had to learn. As Kapuscinski says, everything became an illusion. You wrote fables that, for those who knew, in fact, all about what was happening in the country.
Everything was to be read between the lines.
It had to be.
And what did you do after you were released in 1982? Did you just go back to France?
Yes, I left immediately. They wanted me to stay on. They wanted me to be accomplice to create the illusion that everything was fine and that they were being benevolent and that I was reconverted to good Afrikanerdom or whatever it was called. But I left within 3 days. It was a bit of a rush job because they had to issue me a passport. I didn't have papers anymore. And that I lost immediately, at least. I was then, it was taken away from me, my South African citizenship, and then I was stateless. I thought of becoming a Yugoslav, but then the Yugoslavs also disappear along the way. and became French and then recovered my South African citizenship after the 1990s.
Dubravka, you lived in the former Yugoslavia for more than 40 years before you were forced to leave in 1993?
No, I was not forced. I just left pretty impulsively because I got disgust by the events, less by the events, but more by this fascinating change of the landscape and the human also landscape and the human nature. That was the most fascinating thing, how people changed over the night and became their own blood type, and that was the most important of all. And
being people who had been friends suddenly were enemies simply because one was a Croat and one was a Serb?
No, people simply divided so quickly into those, just to that ethnic identity, and nothing more mattered at that time. So I experienced also all those things Brighton would know, like collective paranoia, like ostracism. I was ostracized because I wrote about that. And
but that was the book, The Culture of Lies?
No, first it was a totally innocent essay, Clean Croatian Air. It refers to souvenir cans, like Coca-Cola cans, empty, though, which was sold all over as a new Croatian souvenir. And it said, clean Croatian air, meaning that now we are clean because there are no others, Serbs and others. So I wrote about that. And then I was attacked in Croatian press, in media. I was ostracized at my work by my colleagues. I worked at the University of Zagreb, Faculty of Arts, for some 20 years. And then this harassment, media harassment, prolonged for several years.
But now, was the media harassment because of the government? Did the government control the media, or were people just outraged that anyone an independent press have been outraged that you would be critical?
No, there was only one newspaper which was independent at that time, and it was Feral Tribune. You know, Feral Herald Tribune, Feral meaning street lamp in a local dialect. So that was the only oppositional newspaper. And, of course, they defended me, but the rest of the journalists, they wanted some target, you know, and the women and women intellectuals are always, it seems, it is almost like a pattern, are the first victims, I mean, and so how the, in fact, witch hunt was opened, you know. So later on, it was very easy to become a public enemy, a traitor, a conspirator against your country, and so on and so on.
My guests are Dubravko Gresic and Brighton Breitenbach. They'll be appearing at 8 o'clock tonight and reading and answering Q&A at the 92nd Street Y. But we have this wonderful opportunity to talk to them now, and we will continue this conversation right after this. We're back with Brighton Breitenbach, whose latest book is called All One Horse, published by Archipelago. Dubravko Gresic, her latest is Nobody's Home from Open Letterpress, and they'll be appearing tonight at 8 o'clock for reading and Q&A at the 92nd Street Y. I want to continue, Dubravko, with what happened in the former Yugoslavia, because most of the focus on the excesses of the time that you've been talking about, the time when you felt that you just had to leave, has been on the Serbian role in the conflict. Was Croatia just as culpable?
I think that it was a chain reaction, you know. So you had exactly the same sort of kind of fascization of the nation, which happened in Croatia too. And then it happened in Bosnia too, I mean in three parts. Then you had almost the same reactions in Macedonia too, and so on. So it's...
And political leaders were spurring this on. Milosevic in Serbia, Tudjman in Croatia.
Yeah, yeah. It was the easiest way to homogenize the nation, the easiest way the war was invented, just to make new states easily.
And the harassment that you were talking about went to the point where they actually published your phone number in the newspaper?
Yeah, they did, four times.
And did you keep on getting calls from crazy people?
Yeah, not from crazy, but from normal, loyal Croats. So, and interestingly enough, people like to do that too, you know, anonymous phone calls, and they like to blame you for all sorts of things. And when women are in question as public enemies, they go sexual too.
So it was obvious there was good reason to leave, but haven't things settled down a bit in Croatia since? Could you say you do return?
Yes, they
could
did.
Could you move back?
No, I could always move back. I could always go back. Yes, things really settled now because everything which was which could be stolen, it was stolen. Everything of public property which could be robbed, it was robbed. So the riches became riches. I mean, people became riches, and the rest of the people, they got impoverished. And
same as in Russia.
Same as in Russia. It's the same pattern. It is called nicely transition. So so you have it all over Eastern Europe, and that's it. And now, when things are settled that way, then it seems that things are much better than they were. I mean, so.
Well, Brighton, you can go back to South Africa after Nelson Mandela came to power. I'm sure all was forgiven. In fact, if anything, you were a favorite son.
Yes, for some, I suppose. In fact, I remember the very first time I actually physically met Mandela, although we were for a while in the same prison. I'd never met him personally.
Robben Island?
No, that was after he was taken from the island and brought to a prison near Cape Town on his way to the final prison from where he was released after a number of years. But of course, prisons were as rigorously segregated as the rest of society, so I never saw him. But I still remember the day he came to the prison I was in because a security officer in a prison complex, which was a big one, walking to my cell. His name was Leroux, meaning red in French. He's also a very red-faced guy. Took off his cap, threw it on my bunk, and he was furious and said, "I suppose you're happy now." I said, "Why?" He says, "Because your boss is here." That's how I knew that Mandela had been transferred. But when I first met Mandela, it was in Paris when he came after his release. Soon afterwards came on a visit to France, and I was allowed to go to the airport to meet him. And I couldn't actually go out on the tarmac. I stood just inside a door of the terminal. It was a military airbase, and he came walking with Madame Mitterrand, and probably about 10 yards away, he looked up and he saw me, and I saw his lips pronounce my name, although we never met. And he came up to me and embraced me and said, "I've come to take you home." So, yes, I could go back. I mean, I have been back. In fact, I go back very often. But I think what I've lost, I'm not sure in your case, what I think my home, which has always been an illusion, I suppose, because it's so intimately intertwined with youth and with struggle for liberation and all of those things. What I lost is that dream that we shared, the dream of building a nation, the dream of greater justice, the dream of tolerance, the dream of understanding the importance of creativity, the dream of bringing together this impossible equation of having overarching shared values but strong separate identities, be they religious, be they linguistic, cultural, or even regional. And all of that has been shattered. So my home was that, in a sense. My home was a dream. It's probably always been just an illusion. And to that I cannot go back. But I do go back to the physical country.
Dubravka, are your books published in Croatian?
Oh, now? Yes, yeah. They are, but...
But you've chosen, at least in this English language edition of your latest book, to have no diacritical marks on your name, which would suggest that you're making some kind of a break.
No, I'm just kind to the typographers and foreign publishers because if they insist on those little guys above letters, they always do it wrongly, so it is better to go without it. No other reason.
My guests are Dubravka Ugresic. By the way, I have written your name with the marks.
Those little guys, okay.
and Brighton Breitenbach, and we're talking about living in exile and creating some kind of a homeland of the mind. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Brighton, can you tell us a bit about your latest book, All One Horse?
Mm.
It's been described as a collection of dream fables. Is that how you would describe it?
I suppose one could call it that. It, you know, particularly in the light of all that we've discussed now, it's going to be a little bit disconcerting for a reader because I don't think he'll find or she will find too many traces of these reflections in there, although I do think they are there. My writing, obviously, and I'm not sure whether this may be true in your case also, Dubravka, a lot of it is not translated or it's not available in English or in French because it's written originally in Afrikaans. And a lot of that is more of the kind that you'll find in All One Horse, either as poetry or as very dense, short prose pieces. I suppose one could say they are to some extent surreal, but I do believe that either through the subject matter to some extent, certainly through the metaphors, I think it still talks of very much the same world that we've been talking about now, a world of incarceration, a world of violence, a world of apathy to some extent, of sacrifice, of blind idealism, and of, I suppose, of very, very deep sadness, of misunderstanding between people or among people.
Each of the stories has a full-page watercolor illustration.
Yes.
And it's often, people have often talked about how poetry and painting are closer in some ways than
That's
poetry
true.
And prose.
I believe that too, yes. I think that one works very much with the same tools when you paint as when you write poetry. I think maybe because the shift is away from what could be ostensibly be the narrative or the need to make sense, or the need to be understood, and say in traditional ways, so that the other components, the texture, the colors, the rhythms, the patterns, the way objects speak to one another, all of these become more important. I think this is what happens to some extent in poetry, and certainly in painting too. Yes, yeah.
So
I think
it has to do with transformation. That's why you put the two of them together.
Yes, yes, yes.
Did one feed the other?
Yes, I think they talk to one another. I would not want to suggest that the one explains or illustrates the other. It's certainly not intended to be that at all. But I would like to imagine that in this kind of a dialogue, on this kind of a reference, cross-reference that arises, maybe some other space opens up. That is really my dream for this book.
You've spent a lot of time here, and in an interview with the Buddhist magazine Tricycle, you said about New Yorkers, they like to make noise. They're like a group of birds, happy as long as they're singing, as if they're all up in a tree together.
Well, I
wonder
to
if
like,
my listeners are going to recognize themselves.
I happen to like birds. I like birds a lot. I've got a lifelong fascination for birds. No, I was talking yesterday again to my wife about that. In New York particularly, I think there's a tolerance for noise levels, which is actually quite fantastic. If you can live with it, it's great. It's fine. But it does mean that everybody is talking very freely, very rapidly, and at the top of her or his voice. And it means you can drive a lorry at 4 o'clock in the morning down one of the canyons. There's reverberation. There's a kind of a trembling going on all the time. And that's probably part of why one is, to some extent, attracted to a city like New York.
Well, it's gotten a lot louder since cell phones became norm, because now there are just too many. I don't know whether this happens in other cities, but in New York, you think there's a crazy person in front of you, and then you realize they're just talking in their cell phone.
I think it's a wonderful thing. I'm sure the psychoanalysts must be going out on strike, because all the people who normally would have been coming to talk to them or via them to God are now doing so directly. And probably with nobody else at the other end of the line. No, this is where birds become autistic. No, it's awful.
Dubravka, your newest book is a collection of essays. A number of the pieces have been published in newspapers previously, but they're very different from the sorts of op-ed pieces that we might see in the New York Times. Is this the sort of thing that gets published in Amsterdam?
No. I was always invited to... I'm not a journalist, or I'm not a regular columnist, so I'm always invited by a newspaper to give, I mean, to write something more literary than, more fiction than nonfiction. And this is why those essays, because are confusing for...
Because they blur the line.
Yes, they blur the line, and I would... More often, I would say that I'm taking more care about that literary side than about being, let's say, very correct in the terms of, you know, dates and so on. But there is also something which I'm using, and that's why they're a little bit confusing, a narrative mask, especially in those short little stories or essays. A narrative mask, so it's not, I would say it's not me, my persona writing those essays, but somebody I've chosen to be my representative. So it's an old literary device. It is called skaz, let's say in Russian literary terminology. And why I'm doing that? Because if you write an essay, then many writers would very easily, unconsciously slip into that authoritarian voice. And this I hate very much, this authoritarian voice.
Like you're the expert.
Yeah, you are an expert, or you play a prophet, or you know the best, or and so on and so on. So that's why I'm playing with this narrative masks.
And you're adding to the book with each edition, aren't you? The Polish edition, which will be out next year, will have more essays than the things you've written since this one?
It's a work in project. In fact, the book in original, Nikogo Nema Doma, Nobody's Home, is half thinner than American edition.
You, in your author's note, you state that picking your nose in public is more forgivable than being pessimistic.
That's true.
But doesn't
isn't
the
it?
Current state of the world force one to be a bit pessimistic? Have you been reading the newspapers recently?
Yeah. But no matter what, you are supposed to be optimist. So,
just one more thing, Brighton. You discuss the notion of being beyond exile in a piece called Notes from the Middle World. And the Middle World, or M-O-R, is what you call it. You say that you're the quintessential Morican, M-O-R-I-C-A-N.
Yeah, a little play, you know, the last of the Mohicans, the first of the Morricans. Yes, that's why I would not consider myself to be in exile. After all, there's nothing stopping me from going back. For me, exile is a fairly well-defined condition to be in, living outside the place that you come from with the hope that things will change enough so that you can go back and be reintegrated again. I don't think that's possible in my case. And I don't think it's possible for many people. I think it's been around for quite a while. I think there's been a coming about of this, what I call a middle world, which is a kind of a place beyond exile, where, you know, this I used a quote which I believe comes from the Middle Ages, some monk who first said this, but I took it from Edward Said, saying that the perfect condition is to be not at home anywhere, as it were. And yes, I think this is true. I think it's also, it's not necessarily linked to having left the place you come from. I think there's one, in the old days, we used to call it internal exile. I used the example of Kafka, for instance, and I'm sure there are many others that one could think of. James Joyce, obviously, Jean Genet in France. I mean, he was never an exile from France, but he was, for me, quintessentially
a non-citizen,
an uncitizen. Beckett, yes, of this middle world. And I think in a work that I've just finished, not yet published, a volume of essays, I try to come to terms or to grips to define it a little more clearly. And I think there are a number of affinities and a number of characteristics that these people have in common. The way they situate themselves to power, to patriotism, to language, to dress, to friendship, to bourgeois values of honesty and dishonesty, to the mask that you talk about.
Do you think it would be different if you had been forced into real exile and could not return? Like the Cuban exiles that keep on talking about going back, or Solzhenitsyn, who ran back the day that he could?
I think that if the conditions, in my case, in South Africa were still such that one was still involved in what we used to call a struggle, I probably would still have considered myself in exile. I think where the penny dropped, to call it that, for me was then when liberation came, and then liberation turned out to be what it turned out to be. And when I went back and I suddenly realized there was no way back, at least not in that sense.
Well, we're pleased that both of you are in New York right now and at the 92nd Street Y tonight. My great thanks to Brighton Breitenbach and to Dubravka Ugresic for being our guest today.
Thank you.
Thank you, too.